Welcome back to Office Hours. I'm Sarah.
And I'm Kiffer. Today is Lesson 9, Environmental Health, Indoor, Built, and Natural Environments. And I want to open with the claim the lesson makes early. Environmental health is the oldest and arguably the most undervalued domain of public health. The largest improvements in population health, Snow's pump handle, Bazalgette's sewers, Clean Air Act's lead phase-outs, have come from environmental engineering rather than from clinical medicine.
And the recurring pattern the lesson names is that environmental exposures matter enormously, regulation lags evidence by decades, and the burden falls disproportionately on marginalized populations.
Right. The structural interventions that work are politically and institutionally difficult to deliver. That's the through line of the whole lesson.
Let's start where the lesson starts. The 1952 London fog.
Early December 1952, a high-pressure weather system trapped cold air over London. A temperature inversion prevented pollutants from dispersing vertically. Coal-burning fireplaces, factories, and power stations continued operating normally. Over 5 days, December 5th through 9th, the smog became so dense, visibility was reduced to a few meters. In some areas, people couldn't see their feet on the ground. The smog penetrated theaters, hospitals, homes. London essentially shut down.
And the mortality.
Temporary records identified approximately 4,000 excess deaths during the event itself. Modern reanalysis by Bell and Davis in 2001, using more rigorous statistical methods, estimated the total excess mortality, including the weeks following, at approximately 12,000. The cause was acute respiratory and cardiovascular failure from the combination of sulfur dioxide and fine particulate matter at extraordinary concentrations.
And the political response was the UK Clean Air Act of 1956.
First major air pollution legislation anywhere in the world, established smoke control areas where smokeless fuels were required, restricted emissions from industrial facilities, subsidized households converting from coal to gas heating. The effects were dramatic. Chronic bronchitis mortality in London fell sharply through the 1960s and 1970s, and the visible smog that had been a feature of London life essentially disappeared. The Donora, Pennsylvania smog of 1948, weighed about 20 deaths over 5 days, had been an earlier U.S. event that produced similar but smaller political response.
And then through the 1970s and 80s, the science shifts from visible smoke to PM 2.5.
Fine particulate matter under 2.5 micrometers in diameter, small enough to penetrate deep into the lungs and enter the bloodstream through the alveolar capillaries. PM 2.5 is largely invisible at the concentrations now considered dangerous. The pivotal study was the Harvard Six Cities study, Dockery and colleagues in the New England Journal of Medicine, 1993.
Walk me through the design.
Roughly 8,000 adults in six U.S. cities, Watertown, Massachusetts, Kingston, Harriman, Tennessee, St. Louis, Steubenville, Ohio, Portage, Wisconsin, Topeka, Kansas, followed prospectively from 1974. Deaths and air pollution exposure characterized for each city. Total mortality was substantially higher in the cities with higher PM 2.5 levels, with effects detectable even at concentrations within the then prevailing regulatory standards, initially contested, subsequently replicated by the American Cancer Society's CPS2 cohort, by the European ESCAPE collaboration, by analogous work elsewhere.
And the guidelines have tightened progressively.
UHO air quality guidelines were 10 micrograms per cubic meter for annual PM 2.5 in 2005, tightened to 5 micrograms per cubic meter in 2021. The Canadian standard sits between at 8.8. The progressive tightening reflects a consistent pattern in environmental health. As detection methods improve and longer follow-up reveals chronic effects, what counts as safe moves downward. Each guideline tightening is the regulator catching up to evidence the field has accumulated for a decade.
And wildfire smoke is now the most consequential recent Canadian exposure.
The 2017, 2018, 2021, and especially 2023 wildfire seasons produced PM 2.5 levels in Canadian and U.S. cities that exceeded any historical air pollution event. The 2023 season was particularly severe. Smoke from northern Quebec, Ontario, and BC fires produced air quality crises that affected populations from Toronto to New York to Washington, D.C. PM 2.5 concentrations during the worst episodes reached over 300 micrograms per cubic meter, 60 times the WHO guideline.
And it's climate amplified.
Wildfires have become more frequent, larger, and longer lasting as climate change has produced hotter and drier conditions in fire-prone areas. The trajectory is unambiguously toward more wildfire smoke exposure in coming decades. The public health response is being built in real time. Provincial air quality alert systems, emergency communications, building ventilation standards for smoke filtration. The infrastructure remains inadequate to the projected exposure trajectory.
Let's move indoors. We spend roughly 90% of our lives indoors.
An indoor environmental regulation lags outdoor environmental regulation by approximately 50 years. The substantial gains on outdoor air haven't been matched by gains on indoor air in most jurisdictions. The lesson walks through four major indoor hazards: radon, asbestos, lead, mold.
Radon first.
Naturally occurring radioactive gas produced by the decay of uranium in soil and rock seeps from the ground into buildings, accumulating to dangerous concentrations in poorly ventilated basements and lower floors. Second leading cause of lung cancer in Canada after smoking. Leading cause among non-smokers. Health Canada estimates approximately 3,200 deaths per year from radon-induced lung cancer.
More than any infectious disease in 2026.
Yeah, and the prevalence varies geographically based on underlying uranium geology. Parts of the Canadian Prairies, the Canadian Shield, Atlantic Canada have elevated radon. Health Canada's reference level is 200 BQ per cubic meter. Approximately 5 to 10% of Canadian homes exceed it. And testing rates are well under 10% in most provinces.
Mitigation is cheap.
Typically, a subslab depressurization system that vents radon from below the foundation to outside. $2,000 to $3,000 for a typical home. The cruel irony is that it's one of the most preventable major cancer causes, cheap, effective intervention, and most Canadian homes are never tested. Real estate disclosure requirements vary by province and are generally weak. Building codes have only recently begun to require radon-resistant construction. BC introduced provincial requirements in 2018.
And the reason most homes are never tested speaks to a general pattern.
Right. The problem has every feature that makes a public health risk hard to act on. Invisible, slow acting, individually rare, even where prevalent, asymptomatic until disease emerges decades later. And the responsibility is privatized to homeowners. Effective public health responses to similar problems, lead paint disclosure at home sale, mandatory smoke detectors, have moved from individual responsibility to regulatory backstops. Canada has not yet made this regulatory move at scale for radon.
Asbestos.
Generic term for a group of fibrous silicate minerals. Heat resistance, structural strength, electrical insulation made them extraordinarily useful as construction and industrial materials. Used extensively in shipbuilding, insulation, brake linings, roofing, flooring throughout the 20th century. Causes asbestosis, lung cancer with substantial synergy with smoking, and mesothelioma, an otherwise rare and uniformly fatal cancer of the pleural lining.
And Canada was a major producer.
The town of Asbestos, Quebec, renamed Val des Sources in 2020, was for decades home to one of the world's largest asbestos mines. Canadian asbestos was exported to many countries, including Quebec public buildings, using asbestos that Canada had banned for its own residential use. The federal government defended asbestos exports through the 1990s and 2000s, despite international medical and public health consensus that all forms of asbestos cause disease and there is no safe exposure level. Canada finally banned new use of asbestos in December 2018, decades after most peer countries.
And the legacy continues.
Canadian mesothelioma incidence is approximately 600 cases per year, predominantly in men with historical occupational exposure. 40-year latency between exposure and onset, so current cases reflect exposures from the 1970s and 1980s. We'll come back to asbestos in Lesson 10, because Selikoff's cohort studies of New York area insulators are the foundational occupational health case.
Lead is a story of about a 90% reduction with persistent gaps.
Lead exposure produced one of the largest preventable injuries to children in the 20th century. Two main pathways: leaded gasoline, which dispersed lead into urban air for decades, and lead-based paint, which produces hand-to-mouth exposure in children, particularly in older housing with deteriorating paint. Lead is a developmental neurotoxin. Childhood blood lead levels are associated with IQ deficits, behavioral problems, reduced educational attainment, with effects detectable at very low concentrations. The Needleman studies in the 1970s and 1980s documented this despite substantial industry opposition.
And the response was substantial.
Leaded gasoline phased out in Canada by 1990. Globally, by 2021, Algeria was the last country to ban it. Leaded paint banned for residential use in Canada in 1976. Lead service lines and newer construction phased out. Blood lead levels in Canadian children have fallen by approximately 90% since 1980. The remaining exposure is concentrated in specific subpopulations, older housing, lead service lines in older municipalities, some imported products, indigenous communities with weaker housing infrastructure. The CDC and Health Canada have progressively lowered the reference blood lead level as evidence has accumulated that no safe level has been identified.
Flint is the cautionary tale.
April 2014, Flint, Michigan switched its drinking water source from the Detroit system to the Flint River as a cost-cutting measure under emergency management. The Flint River water was substantially more corrosive. The Flint water system's lead service lines began leaching lead into the drinking water. Residents complained from the beginning, taste, smell, appearance, and their complaints were dismissed by state officials. Children's blood lead levels rose substantially. A Legionnaires outbreak in 2014 and 2015 killed at least 12 people and was probably water related.
And the case was broken by persistent advocacy.
Mona Hannah Atisha, a pediatrician who documented elevated childhood blood lead levels and published the findings. Mark Edwards, a Virginia Tech environmental engineer who documented elevated lead in drinking water samples. And Flint residents who refused to be dismissed. State and federal officials had ignored or actively concealed evidence for over a year. The Flint case illustrates environmental racism. A majority Black low-income city under emergency management received treatment that a majority white affluent city would not have.
Mold and sick building syndrome and the post-COVID conversation.
Indoor mold growth driven by water intrusion and inadequate ventilation is associated with respiratory symptoms, asthma exacerbations, and rarely more severe illness in immunocompromised people. The strongest evidence is for asthma morbidity in children. Mold in housing is particularly common in older, poorly maintained, low-income housing, and is one of the structural mechanisms by which inadequate housing produces health disparities. Sick building syndrome was formally recognized by WHO in 1984. Headache, fatigue, respiratory irritation, skin irritation in occupants of certain buildings, with symptoms resolving when the person leaves, real but heterogeneous, with specific causes often hard to identify.
And COVID reopened the indoor air question.
Respiratory virus transmission depends substantially on indoor air quality, the same ventilation, filtration, and humidity factors that reduce other indoor air problems also reduce respiratory infection transmission. The 2020 to 2022 push for improved ventilation in schools, workplaces, and public spaces produced substantial structural change in some jurisdictions. ASHRAE updated its ventilation standards in 2023 to incorporate respiratory infection control. The implementation has been uneven. The case for continued investment is increasingly recognized.
Let's talk about the built environment, because the lesson treats it as one of the largest population health interventions any society makes, often without realizing it.
The 20th century North American development pattern, car-dependent suburban sprawl, separated land uses, single-family zoning, was not designed as a public health intervention, but it has had enormous public health consequences. The contemporary movement toward walkable, mixed-use, transit-oriented development is explicitly framed as public health work in many cities.
Walkability and active transport first.
Neighborhoods that allow people to walk for daily errands have higher rates of physical activity, lower rates of obesity, lower air pollution exposure, and stronger social ties. The classic observations come from Jane Jacobs in The Death and Life of Great American Cities, 1961. The empirical literature is methodologically tricky. Selection effects, because active people choose walkable neighborhoods, but quasi-experimental designs using new transit lines and neighborhood redevelopment support a real causal effect.
The numbers on active transport are substantial.
People who commute by walking or cycling have 20 to 30% lower all-cause mortality compared with car commuters in matched studies. Mechanism is partly direct physical activity, partly reduced air pollution exposure, partly reduced sedentary time and stress. Copenhagen, Amsterdam, several European cities made cycling a primary urban transport mode through sustained infrastructure investment. Cycling mode share in central Copenhagen exceeds 50%.
And Vancouver's growth has been real.
Vancouver's cycling mode share has grown from approximately 4% in 2000 to approximately 12% in 2024. Portland and Montreal have invested similarly. Toronto, Calgary, others have invested less and seen less growth. The barrier to active transport investment is political, not empirical. Reallocating road space is controversial. Reducing parking provision is controversial. Changing land use patterns is controversial. Successful programs have required sustained political leadership over multiple election cycles.
Food environment.
Distribution and types of food retailers, prices, marketing, infrastructure in an area. Predicts dietary patterns and obesity prevalence. The concept has been refined since its 1990s introduction. Simple food desert metrics, distance to nearest supermarket, predict less of the dietary variation than initial work suggested. The food environment operates through more complex pathways, including price, marketing, time pressure, social norms, cultural factors.
And opening a supermarket in a food desert isn't enough.
Philadelphia's Fresh Food Financing Initiative, one of the most studied food desert interventions, produced disappointing dietary effects despite successful supermarket placement. Many of the most effective food environment changes, price, marketing, labeling, operate at scales above the neighborhood. Mexico's sugar tax, which we covered in Lesson 4, operates nationally. Chile's front-of-package warning labels operate nationally. Canadian front-of-package warnings, mandatory by 2026 for foods high in saturated fat, sugar, and sodium, also operate nationally. Local-level food environment interventions have had success on specific sub-questions. Restrictions on fast food outlets near schools, school food environment changes, Quebec's advertising to children restrictions since 1980.
Green space.
Access to parks, urban forests, street trees, and natural environments is associated with reduced cardiovascular disease, improved mental health, lower stress biomarkers, and lower all-cause mortality. Mechanisms include increased physical activity, reduced air pollution exposure, stress recovery, restorative attention effects, the Kaplan's attention restoration theory, and social interaction in shared public spaces. Disentangling these has been methodologically difficult, but the cumulative population level effect has been consistently demonstrated.
And the equity dimension is sharp?
Green space is unequally distributed by neighborhood, income, and race in essentially every North American city studied. The 330-300 rule, proposed by Cecil Konijnendijk and adopted by some Canadian cities, every resident should be able to see at least 3 trees from their home, have 30% tree canopy in their neighborhood, and be within 300 meters of a green space. Implementation requires sustained investment in greening of historically underserved neighborhoods.
Health in All Policies frames a lot of this.
Ottawa Charter, 1986, called for building healthy public policy across sectors. The operational framework that descends from it is Health in All Policies, HIAP, articulated by the Finnish Public Health Establishment in the 2000s and adopted by WHO in 2013. Policy decisions in non-health sectors, transportation, housing, agriculture, education, taxation, criminal justice, have substantial health consequences and should be evaluated for those consequences as part of normal policy development. Quebec has adopted HIAP formally since 2004. Most Canadian jurisdictions have not.
Water, wildfires, and climate, the final section of the lesson.
Some environmental crises are acute and local. Some are slow and global. Walkerton in May 2000 is the acute case.
Walk me through it.
Drinking water of Walkerton, Ontario, population about 5,000, became contaminated with E. coli O157H7 and Campylobacter jejuni from agricultural runoff that had entered an inadequately protected well. 7 people died. More than 2,300 became ill, over 40% of the town's population. Many survivors developed long-term sequelae, including chronic kidney disease and post-infectious irritable bowel syndrome.
And the inquiry produced reforms.
Justice Dennis O'Connor's inquiry produced a detailed forensic analysis. The well had been known to be vulnerable. Chlorination equipment had failed in the days before the outbreak, and the failure hadn't been recognized. The water utility manager had falsified records. The municipal water system was inadequately overseen. The provincial Ministry of the Environment had been weakened by 1990s budget cuts. Each failure alone would have been insufficient. In combination, they were catastrophic. The reforms kept the Safe Drinking Water Act in 2002, mandatory operator certification, enhanced inspection, have been credited with preventing analogous outbreaks.
And climate change is the slow, diffuse case.
Lancet Countdown publishes annual indicators. Heat-related mortality in people aged 65 plus rose by approximately 85% globally between 1990 to 2000 and 2013 to 2022. Drought-related food insecurity, wildfire smoke exposure increases, vector-borne disease range shifts for Lyme disease moving north into Canada, West Nile, dengue establishing in parts of Europe and the southern U.S. mental health effects of climate change, both direct climate anxiety and indirect through acute event sequelae.
The 2021 BC Heat Dome is the canonical Canadian climate health event.
June 25th to July 1st, 2021, 619 excess deaths in BC in 5 days. Temperatures reached 49.6 degrees Celsius in Lytton, BC, the highest temperature ever recorded in Canada. Lytton itself burned to the ground the day after that record was set. The deaths were concentrated in low-income housing, without air conditioning, older adults living alone, people with chronic conditions. It is the deadliest weather event in Canadian history.
And the political asymmetry of acute versus chronic crises is informative.
Aukerton killed 7 people and was followed by comprehensive reform, legislation, inspections, oversight. The 2021 heat dome killed 619 people in 5 days and produced more limited reform. Acute events have clear causes, clear responsibility, clear ends. Aukerton had a contaminated well, specific failures of monitoring, identifiable people whose decisions mattered, and an inquiry that produced legislation. The heat dome's cause is climate change, diffuse, decades in the making, with no single decision maker to blame and no single intervention to point to. Acute, geographically bounded events produce political action. Chronic, diffuse, global events produce statements and slow incrementalism.
And one of public health's tasks is making chronic harms politically legible.
That's one of the things the field can contribute. The 2025 Canadian Federal Climate Adaptation Strategy includes substantial public health elements: heat action planning, wildfire smoke health protection, vector-borne disease surveillance, climate-related mental health programming. Whether these are implemented adequately is a substantive policy question of the late 2020s. The mitigation-adaptation distinction matters. Even aggressive mitigation will not prevent additional warming from already emitted greenhouse gases. So substantial public health adaptation is unavoidable, regardless of mitigation success.
Let's bring this together. Takeaways.
Go ahead.
First takeaway: environmental engineering, clean water, clean air, sewers, lead phase-out, smoke-free environments has delivered most of public health's largest population-scale gains. Clinical medicine matters, but the structural environmental moves are the largest single category of public health success.
Second takeaway: the 1952 London fog, the 1956 UK Clean Air Act, the Six Cities Study, and the WHO guidelines that have progressively tightened from 10 to 5 micrograms per cubic meter annual PM2.5 tell a story of evidence catching up to lower and lower exposure thresholds. The pattern recurs for lead, for asbestos, for many other exposures. Current standards are typically too lax, not too strict.
Third takeaway: the indoor environment is regulated about 50 years behind the outdoor environment. Rodden causes roughly 3,200 lung cancer deaths in Canada per year, mostly preventable, and Canadian testing rates are below 10%. Asbestos was banned in Canada in 2018, decades late, and the legacy continues to produce 600 mesothelioma cases per year. COVID has reopened the indoor air question in transformative ways.
Fourth takeaway: the built environment is one of the largest unintentional population health interventions any society makes. Walkable, mixed-use, transit-oriented development produces measurable physical activity, mortality, and mental health gains. The barriers to active transport are political, not empirical. The 330-300 rule and health in all policies frameworks are the contemporary operational tools.
Fifth takeaway: Aukerton and Flint are the canonical case studies for what happens when regulatory oversight fails. Both produced acute identifiable harm and clear regulatory and legal responses. Both also illustrate environmental racism and class. The populations affected were not random.
Sixth takeaway: the 2021 BC heat dome is the deadliest weather event in Canadian history. Climate change is now an unambiguous public health emergency. The acute versus chronic political asymmetry: Aukerton kills 7 and produces legislation. The heat dome kills 619 and produces incremental reform is one of the structural reasons climate change is hard to act on. Making chronic harm politically legible is one of public health's contemporary tasks.
Seventh takeaway: air quality, indoor environment, built environment, water, and climate are all part of the same domain. The field has historically siloed them. the contemporary direction is integrating them, recognizing that wildfire smoke is a climate-amplified outdoor air pollutant that becomes an indoor air problem in inadequately filtered buildings, that the built environment determines exposure to all of these, and that the equity dimension cuts across every one of them.
One synthesizing thought before we close. Most of what produces population health is upstream of the health system. Clean air, clean water, safe housing, safe streets, accessible green space, working ventilation. These are public health problems, but the levers are held by transport ministries, environment ministries, housing ministries, municipal planning departments, building codes. The contemporary public health practitioner needs to be able to engage with those domains, not just with clinical care.
Before we move from air pollution, the methodology piece is worth a brief callback. The Six Cities study founded modern PM2.5 epidemiology, and the methods have proliferated.
Several distinct study designs are now standard in air pollution research. Cohort studies, Six Cities, ACS-CPS2, ESCAPE in Europe, examine long-term exposure and chronic outcomes. Time series studies examine short-term exposure and acute outcomes by regressing daily mortality or hospital admissions on daily PM2.5. Controlling for season, day of week, and long-term trends. Case crossover studies use each case as their own control, eliminating subject-level confounders that don't vary over short time scales. Quasi-experimental studies exploit natural experiments. The 2002 Dublin coal ban, the 2008 Beijing Olympic air quality intervention, to estimate effects of regulatory changes. The contemporary methodological frontier is exposure assessment, with land use regression, satellite-derived estimates, and personal monitoring all in play.
And on the radon side, the evidence base is mostly built on occupational cohorts.
Right. The strongest dose-response evidence comes from cohorts of uranium miners exposed to very high radon concentrations. The Czech Joachimsthal miners, the U.S. Colorado Plateau miners, the Canadian El Dorado miners at Beaver Lodge and Port Radium. Extrapolation from high-dose occupational to low-dose residential exposure is methodologically tricky, but supported by the European Pooled Residential Radon Studies, Darby and colleagues in the BMJ in 2005, and the North American Pooled Studies, Krosky and colleagues in the same period, that demonstrate dose response at residential exposure levels using case-control designs.
And the built environment research has its own methodological challenges. People aren't randomly assigned to neighborhoods.
That's the biggest one. People who choose walkable neighborhoods differ from those who don't in ways that affect health independently. Naive cross-sectional comparison substantially overestimates causal effects. The methods that address this, quasi-experimental designs exploiting new transit lines and bike infrastructure, mover studies, difference in differences, all have limitations. But the convergent evidence across designs is increasingly compelling. The walkability measurement infrastructure has also matured. WalkScore, walkability indices combining street connectivity and residential density, and land use mix. Street view-based assessments using machine learning, GPS-based exposure assessment measuring actual time spent in different environments, CANUE, the Canadian Urban Environmental Health Research Consortium, has driven Canadian methodology development.
And one more piece I want to mention, climate attribution science.
Yeah. Probabilistic event attribution compares the probability of an event of given severity in observed climate versus counterfactual climate without anthropogenic forcing, using climate model simulations. The World Weather Attribution Network, founded in 2014, produces rapid attribution analyses for major events. The 2021 Pacific Northwest Heat Dome was attributed by WWA as virtually impossible without climate change. The combination of attribution science with heat mortality methodology now permits estimates of climate change attributable mortality. How many deaths would not have occurred without anthropogenic climate change? The methodology is still maturing, but the framework is increasingly central to climate health policy.
I want to ask one more thing on the indoor environment piece, sick building syndrome, and what happened to that diagnosis.
Sick building syndrome was useful as a flag, a constellation of symptoms in occupants of certain buildings, with symptoms resolving when the person leaves. Headache, fatigue, respiratory irritation, skin irritation, it captures something real. The diagnostic specificity was low, though, which has limited regulatory response. Specific causes are often hard to identify. Combinations of poor ventilation, volatile organic compound emissions from materials, mold, dust mite allergens, other factors. And SBS has occasionally been weaponized in workplace disputes and litigation in ways that made building owners and clinicians wary of the diagnosis. The post-COVID indoor air conversation has substantially reframed the issue. The same ventilation and filtration that reduces respiratory virus transmission also reduces SBS symptoms. The intervention is the same, regardless of which framing you use, which is partly why the field is moving.
And lessons from HVAC investment during the pandemic.
Some Canadian school boards and workplaces substantially upgraded ventilation infrastructure between 2020 and 2022. The implementation has been uneven. Some jurisdictions have maintained the investment and continued upgrading. Others have let it lapse. The case for continued investment is increasingly recognized in indoor air science, but the funding politics are difficult. Ventilation upgrades are expensive, the benefits are diffuse, and the constituencies for them are weaker than for more visible interventions.
On the food environment piece, the lesson made an interesting point about Quebec's advertising restrictions.
Quebec has restricted advertising of food and other products to children under 13 since 1980 under the Consumer Protection Act. So the province has roughly 45 years of natural experiment data on advertising restrictions. The evidence is mixed, but generally supports modest reductions in childhood obesity and unhealthy food consumption compared with the rest of Canada. The federal restrictions on food advertising to children through 2025 amendments to the Food and Drugs Act are now extending the Quebec approach federally. It's a useful example of how provincial-level policy experiments can inform federal policy decades later.
One more quick exchange. I want to ask about the equity dimension explicitly because it cuts across every piece of this lesson.
Yeah, environmental health disparities are not random. The 1952 London fog killed people in the East End disproportionately because of housing quality and proximity to industry. Radon exposure varies geographically, but the failure to test runs through housing tenure. Renters can't compel landlords to test or mitigate. Lead exposure has been disproportionately in older housing in lower income neighborhoods. Asbestos exposure was concentrated in working class industries like shipbuilding, construction, insulation. Indigenous communities continue to face drinking water advisories. The built environment is unequally distributed with green space, walkability, and clean air all correlating with neighborhood income. Wildfire smoke during the 2023 episodes hit outdoor workers and people without air conditioning hardest. The 2021 heat dome killed people in low-income housing without air conditioning. Climate vulnerability tracks the same pattern. The equity dimension isn't a side issue, it's the structure.
And that's a thread that goes through the whole rest of the course.
Lesson 11 picks it up explicitly under social determinants. Lesson 10 next time will pick it up through occupational health, where the exposures are even more concentrated in specific populations, and the regulatory infrastructure has been even more reactive.
Next lesson is occupational health and worker safety. The 18th century chimney sweeps, the radium girls, the modern gig work landscape.
Closely related to this one, different setting, same pattern of slow regulation catching up to evidence. See you next time.
Take care, everyone.